Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
And now.
Brain systems arm. T-minus 10 seconds. Go for main engine start. 7, 6, 5, 3 engines up and burning. 3, 2, 1, and liftoff of Space Shuttle Discovery, beginning America's new journey to the moon, Mars, and beyond. And the vehicle has cleared the tower.
After months of anticipation, the Space Shuttle Discovery blasted off at Cape Canaveral, Florida this morning. This is NASA's first manned space launch since the 2003 Columbia disaster that killed all 7 crew members on board. Today's takeoff was delayed 2 weeks ago due to a faulty fuel gauge, so there was some anticipation. And joining us on the line is Steve Petranek, editor-in-chief of Discover Magazine, for more. And Steve, I'm sure you were one of those holding your breath a little as you watched this liftoff. How did it look?
I have to admit, I was nervous. It looked fabulous. It always looks flawless when they take off.
Yeah, well, we have to remind ourselves that the tragedies, at least one in the past, were on reentry, so we haven't completely exhaled.
That's correct. Getting it back safely on the ground is the real test.
Yeah. Well, we mentioned that there was this fuel gauge problem that we all know about. It stalled the previous launches. What happened today? I mean, we were told yesterday that if it had showed up again, they might take off regardless.
Well, it's not a critical function. I think NASA was just very wary on the first launch. They wanted to reconsider everything and have time to reconsider stuff. It was kind of a tricky weather launch when they tried this a little more than a week ago. So. I think they just decided to pack it in and make sure they were doing the right thing. And now that they've reevaluated it, they realize that it's not exactly essential to flight.
Right. Well, as we watched it on television, and again, it was difficult to watch, you realized how nerve-wracking this has become. You could see incredible shots of Discovery's fuel tank as the shuttle climbed into orbit, a camera attached to the shuttle. And we understand there were 2 chase planes, more than 100 cameras overall. Is this in reaction to what has happened previously, and what will happen to all of this information?
Yes. When Columbia went up, if we had known either by really good camera work that a piece of foam had fallen against the wing and knocked off tiles and perhaps knocked a hole in the wing, if we just had this information, it's conceivable that we could have done something to get that crew back safely, whether getting them to the International Space Station at that point was possible or not. NASA said it wasn't, but now all of a sudden Discovery can launch with or can dock with the space station in an emergency and transfer the astronauts to the space station. But knowing what is happening to the space vehicle is really the heart of the new safety system, because for the first time we can take astronauts out of the orbiter itself and give them a repair kit, and they can actually replace tiles that might get broken on launch or fix certain kinds of damage to the shuttle
I think
once it's in orbit.
Isn't it true that on this mission they're actually going to do a practice run at trying that?
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are going to be 3 spacewalks, and one of those spacewalks specifically is going to be, can we fix something that's wrong?
Well, and to follow on what you were saying, in 2003, NASA could barely make out the blow that actually caused the problem in the photographs of the launch then, because the few images were so poor. So I'm imagining that right now they are poring over all of these fixed cameras, tapes, and the tapes from the airplanes to see if there was any...
You know, it's funny. little video cameras cost about $40 a piece, so NASA has covered the space shuttle with little cameras so they can see everything. And they now have a new gadget attached to the boom in the main cargo bay that allows them to see almost every single part of the shuttle just using the boom from inside. So they can examine it and examine it and examine it. And not only that, they've added hundreds of sensors to the wings and to critical surfaces on the orbiter itself, so they can sense temperature and sense failure points.
But again, and maybe you felt the same way, Steve, as we were watching it and seeing all of these new vantage points that we didn't have before, I felt even more nervous. Because, and you're thinking also that the First Lady, Laura Bush, was in attendance, the governor of Florida. people who, survivors of those who had died in the Columbia disaster, family members were all there with this incredible ringside seat of the takeoff. It was also kind of nerve-wracking.
I think people are beginning to figure out that space travel and traveling into space is not safe. This is the most complicated device that humans have ever built. It has literally millions of possible failures. There are so many things that could go wrong, you probably couldn't even list them all. So it's a miracle every time it gets up and it actually gets into orbit and it comes back safely. And we got complacent because of the really pretty amazing safety record that the shuttle has had, that this was just happenstance and you'd go up and it was a commonplace, ordinary thing and you would expect it to come down safely. And now that we've lost two of them, I think we've figured out that space travel isn't quite as safe as we thought. Yeah.
Steve Petranek is editor-in-chief of Discover magazine. Steve, just remind us in the few seconds we have, what happens now? How long are they up and when do they come down?
They'll be up for most of a week. They will do three major spacewalks. They will replace a major guidance gyroscopic stabilizing system on the space station, which is actually pretty important. And believe me, when they come down, I think we can be very confident that it will be a very smooth landing.
Steve Petranek, editor-in-chief, Discover magazine. Thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Pleasure.
Turning to London, where British Prime Minister Tony Blair met at 10 Downing Street today with opposition leaders to talk about tough new legislation to counter the terrorist threat in that country. The opposition leaders have expressed reservations about some of the key proposals of the new counterterrorism law, but the general tone is one of solid support for the Blair government. Joining us now from London is Matthew Tempest, political correspondent for The Guardian newspaper. And Matthew, how are others reacting to this new proposed legislation and this idea of cracking down in ways that Britons have not seen before on terror suspects?
I think in the wake of a massive bomb terrorist attack on London and a second attempted one last week, there's general widespread public support for most of these measures, and that's reflected in the fact that the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, invited the leaders of both the opposition parties, one of which, of course, opposed the Iraq war and the other which supported it, into Downing Street to try and get a consensus across the political spectrum before bringing in a law in the autumn, come September, October time, when Parliament returns from its summer break. The idea is that there'll be almost a unanimous vote in the Commons, and then the law can be passed very quickly.
Well, but there is some controversy. So tell us, first of all, it seems to be a three-pronged proposal. Tell us what the suggestions are.
Well, what's not controversial is that there could be a new offence along the lines of acts preparatory to terrorism or inciting terrorism, and that would be aimed at dealing with radical clerics and Islamist extremists who try to provoke or incite religious hatred and young followers.
And Matthew, I want to hold you up there because we've talked about this on the show, especially in the wake of the bombings, that in Britain, previous to this, there's been sort of an understanding that this kind of language, these kinds of rallies would be allowed rather than make them illegal and risk driving them underground. So obviously that's changed.
Sure. Well, the thinking in the past has been that it's better to have, well, we also have a tradition of free speech in this country, which, you know, civil libertarians care greatly about. But there was also the thinking that it was better to have these people where we could see them and hear them, and presumably the security services were monitoring and giving them surveillance, rather than drive them underground. I think in the wake of the bombings in July and the deaths in London, that policy has now changed, and these people are either going to be arrested, charged and imprisoned or deported.
Well, Matthew, an interesting side note, we understand that there's precedent for conversation and debate about just this issue. We're reading a column in the British paper, The New Statesman, that points out that in 1871, European ambassadors went to the British government and asked them to muzzle a certain dangerous man by the name of Karl Marx, who had sought asylum in Britain after being kicked out of Germany.
Of course, I mean, London has for centuries played a role as a magnet across Europe for political revolutionaries and dissidents, and Lenin as well was a resident in London briefly. Gandhi, a peaceful revolutionary, also came to the British capital. And there is a fear that this could now be under threat. On the other hand, many other European countries have criticised the British government for allowing London to be what nicknamed Londonistan in terms of the sheer number of radical Islamic clerics who have either set up home in the capital or sought political refuge here.
Well, in fact, it was seen by many as chiding the British government when President Musharraf of Pakistan commented that organizations that were allowed to speak freely in Britain were actually outlawed in Pakistan.
That's true, and Britain has until recently at least had a very liberal tradition of allowing organizations and political groups which may have been banned elsewhere.
Yeah. And there's the famous Speaker's Corner as well.
Absolutely, in Hyde Park, yes, very famous. But there are new measures, not to do with the laws proposed today, but a new measure is also controversial, that to prevent the incitement to religious hatred, because some comedians and artists and writers fear that it will stop them criticising evangelical Christianity or Judaism or Islam. But I think that's also probably going to come in the near future.
And so what else is the Blair legislation looking for?
Well, what this morning's meeting did find controversial is there's a request from the police to extend the amount of time that they can detain without charging suspects on terrorism offences from the current limit, which is 2 weeks, to 3 months. And the police say that's for operational reasons, which is that in the past they've had problems just garnering all the evidence from forensic evidence from bomb sites and from flats where suspects have been living and preparing it all in time. However, I think from the Prime Minister right through to the opposition leaders, there's some scepticism about changing the law to allow people to be detained without charge for 3 months, which is an extremely long time for people who then may just be released.
Well, as these talks about proposed new legislation are underway, running parallel is the fact that Brits and politicians in Britain are discovering that, in fact, there was a shoot-to-kill policy that was secretly instituted in the country in 2003. Of course, we saw it carried out last week on the subway shooting of the Brazilian man. How are people reacting to the fact that this is a policy that was instituted in complete secrecy?
There is a growing political debate and controversy about this, in fact. I mean, certainly from London's Muslim and ethnic minority communities, there's a great fear now that anybody who disobeys a police command doesn't hear it. You know, there's a paranoia almost that the police now have almost a trigger-happy carte blanche to shoot people they believe to be terrorist suspects. Now, that may be going too far. That said, in the wake of last week's horrible tragedy where this innocent Brazilian man was shot 8 times in the head in front of a crowded tube of passengers, this has certainly become one of the burning issues of the summer here in London.
Matthew Tempest is political correspondent for The Guardian of London. He's speaking to us from London. Matthew, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, just ahead, why would young Brits even turn to terror? What makes them choose a suicide knapsack? Our next guest says it's because Al-Qaeda is a cult and they've been brainwashed. Also later in the program, a Boston hospital sets out to bridge the gap between the races when it comes to health care. More coming up here and now. Now, and we're continuing our conversation about the recent terror attacks in London. Britons are trying to understand how young British Muslims suspected in this month's transit system bombings turned towards terrorism. Neighbors of some of the men have said they were good lads, but some of the suspects' relatives paint a different picture. They've said that anger over the war in Iraq motivated the young men. One suspect even boasted to relatives in Pakistan of becoming a holy warrior. Well, for another view on what might make an average person turn to suicide bombing, we want to spend a few minutes with Stephen Hassan. He's author of 2 books on cults. He's also a sought-after cult deprogrammer. He counsels people to get them to come out of cults, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, as you watched this story unfold after 9/11 in particular, and then more recently in the last couple of weeks, do you think that the suicide bombers that we've seen in London, in Egypt, on 9/11, do you think they're a member of a cult?
I would say that they are under mind control or indoctrination, and that's one of the biggest things that have been left out, in my opinion, in the reporting, is the leaving out the social recruitment, the deception, the manipulation, the indoctrination, and the creation of a cult identity that basically has a very black and white, us versus them, good versus evil mentality, where members are told that they're not allowed to think negative thoughts about their what they've been taught, where they're made to feel dependent on the group or what they believe is on God, but in fact, on human interpreters of Scripture.
Do you think Osama bin Laden qualifies for that sort of godlike character?
I believe he qualifies as the leader of a destructive cult, absolutely. I mean, there's no question that it's destructive and that it's harmed untold numbers of innocent citizens. But I really put the emphasis on behavior rather than belief. I mean, there are features of cult mentality. But for me, as a mental health professional trained in social psychology, I look at how is the person approached initially and what processes are done to get them to the point where they are willing to die even though they have a wife and young children.
Well, we have just a little bit of insight into that. For instance, there's a young man named Niaz Khan. He's now 21 years old, but he gave an interview in Britain and he was quoted in a recent Wall Street Journal article talking about how he was recruited outside of a gambling casino. He had $16,000 in debts. He was approached by a stranger who said, "You've done a mistake, but God will forgive you if you do something for Islam." He was invited to dinner, and eventually he agreed to join a group and travel to a city near Lahore in Pakistan for training in how to seize an airplane. He turned himself into the FBI. Mm-hmm. But is that what you're talking about, sort of a vulnerable person is approached and then worked through a system until they end up isolated at a training camp?
Yes. There are a variety of situational variables that would make an intelligent, educated person more susceptible to a cult recruiter. Death of a loved one, breaking up in a relationship, losing a job. But it's amazing to me how many people who come from intact families, who are happy, who are educated, can be deceived and then systematically manipulated, sometimes through the use of hypnotic methods, indeed, into an isolated area where everything is controlled. Their sleep is controlled. Their diet is controlled. An assault is made on their current belief system and their identity, and they begin to work on giving this person a new identity. I've also heard stories of people who are buried in a coffin in the ground with dirt put on top of the coffin and then left there and then dug up just before they suffocate, and they're told, "You are dead now, but Allah has one more task for you to do."
Do we know that these kinds of things are happening at these training
camps?
Just
public information, right. And there are a number of experts who've been working with suicide bombers in Israel, and I've been following their work very closely as well. But I have to be honest, I was in a cult in the 70s, which is how I got interested in this field, and I've spent 30 years counseling people. But when I was in the cult that I was in,
I was the
Moonies. Mm-hmm. I was trained to die on command or kill on command.
Mm. Have you ever deprogrammed a terrorist?
I've counseled people involved with terrorist groups, including Aum Shinrikyo, which was the sarin gas cult in Japan. I've worked with people involved with the Rajneesh, or now known as the Osho cult, that put salmonella poisoning in salad bars out in Oregon. I've talked with one Arab American who was recruited into a mosque in the United States and was being indoctrinated into believing that suicide bombing would be a good thing. Unfortunately, he never pursued it, and he and his parents left the mosque.
Well, will you give us insight then? How did that indoctrination take place? How did it go?
Well, it's an issue of incremental exposure to things. And the more an authority figure can shape reality into a "trust me, I know God's will," the more easily it is to start rationalizing different actions. But the important thing that I want to emphasize is that we need to apply our knowledge of cult psychology to the war on terrorism. It's not going to be won by military and police means.
Well, how would you do that? What would you apply about what you know about people who are in cults to people who are members of Al-Qaeda?
Well, for example, a lot of the people who have said they didn't know that their loved ones were thinking about doing suicide bombing, a lot of these people saw a radicalization in the people's belief systems before. There's a whole list of assessment questions that I'd like to see the public informed about so that they can engage in their own on their own level with their loved ones.
Such as? Give us a question.
Such as, do you have some new friends? If so, what are their names? Mm-hmm. And who are they? And can we meet them? Mm-hmm. And if the answer is no, I can't share my friends' names with you, some warning lights should go up that you have a big problem. Yeah.
Stephen, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure, Robin. Thank you.
Stephen Hassan is a mental health counselor and cult expert. He's also author of Releasing the Bonds, Empowering People to Think for Themselves. Tomorrow on Here and Now, the politics of the morning after pill. Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney says the pill is more than contraception. It can be used as an abortion pill. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead Here and Now. Today, one of the leading hospitals here in Boston is launching what it says is the first hospital-based center trying to eliminate racial disparities in healthcare. It's an issue that's been gaining attention in recent years in both the medical and research worlds. Recent reports have found that blacks and Latinos have higher rates than whites of infant mortality, diabetes, asthma, and HIV. Well, now Massachusetts General Hospital is moving to bridge that gap with its Disparities Solution Center. Here in House, Bob Oak spoke with the director of the center, Dr. Joseph Betancourt, and asked just how does he plan to go about tackling the problem of racial disparity in healthcare.
I think the center really distinguishes itself from other centers around the country in that it will not only be conducting research. We plan to tackle the issue of disparities in a very action-oriented way. We plan to work hand-in-hand with key healthcare stakeholders, health plans, hospitals, city and state government, physician organizations, and other healthcare provider organizations to really implement and evaluate practical solutions to address disparities. And by that I mean we plan to really work on the ground to develop new programs, new strategies that tackle the problem head on and really take research and publications and convert that into public action.
Give us an example of a program that's working right now to close the gap that you're impressed by and that you might try to build on.
You know, we had the good fortune of participating in certain activities in New York City, for example, that I think provide a wonderful model for how we might do our work in the future. In a previous case, working with a managed care plan in New York, where disparities in asthma management were identified. In essence, children with asthma, minority children, tended to be having worse outcomes, not adhering to their medications as well. And in essence, really, we identified a disparity in that plan. What we were able to do was work hand-in-hand with that plan and develop a disease management program, a targeted strategy that addressed the needs of those children that allowed the plan itself to do more in the area of education, to provide language services, to provide additional case management that really, in essence, eliminated the disparities over the course of a year, year and a half. So through their disease management program and through a tailored, customized approach, we really were able to address disparities. And I think that model of really making disease management more culturally competent, more targeted at disparities, is a wonderful model that we hope to move forward with a variety of plans across the country.
In addressing the problem, how much of it needs to go outside of the healthcare system? And what I mean by that is, how do you deal with class differences, poor housing, unequal education, unequal job opportunities? How do you get around those?
Well, I think the center really distinguishes two issues. One, disparities in health, which I think all the things that you mentioned are significant root causes. The fact that we see that minorities have poor health outcomes for conditions such as cancer and heart disease and others, diabetes, really are due to a whole set of factors that include, again, as you mentioned, education, housing, and issues related to public health. Those issues really need to to be addressed if we're ever going to eliminate disparities in health. Our center will focus on really what happens to patients when they get into the healthcare system. And so we'll try to really make sure that every patient that is seen in the healthcare system receives the best we have to offer. So in sum, I think we'll work and partner with other centers around the country and other activities that focus on the larger issue of disparities in health and tackle the issues of socioeconomic status, education, housing, the environment. But our particular focus will be what goes on within the healthcare system.
It's clear, according to the research, that some minorities simply don't trust healthcare providers. How do you deal with that specifically?
Yeah, I think that that's been a very significant finding and really based in much of our nation's history and issues ranging from segregation in the Tuskegee syphilis study to issues that we see today that lead to mistrust among, again, all patients, but particularly minority patients. I think that this is not a mountain that we can't climb. There are promising strategies and simple strategies to begin to build trust with all our patients. With African Americans and minorities and others who are particularly mistrustful, I think things as simple in the doctor's office as communicating the fact that we are committed to doing all we can and to work in partnership with them, to let them know that we're aware that this issue of mistrust is alive and well and that we really want to do everything we can, again, to build trust and to provide the best care we can. I think some of those things, both at the micro level in the doctor's office, and then as a healthcare system, our hospitals and health plans communicating our knowledge of mistrust and our efforts to bridge mistrust, I think will really go a long way in addressing this problem.
Which I think leads to this question. How much of this needs to be on the doctors themselves? How much of this needs to focus on designing a program to make physicians more culturally sensitive?
That's a great question. I think, in the Institute of Medicine report on equal treatment, we very clearly said there's no one suspect and no one solution here. And so we really felt that this needs to be a multi-tiered strategy. We need to engage in activities around health systems design. We need to work with patients. And I think, as such, we need to work with healthcare providers as well. I think this issue of cultural competence really is striving to do a very simple thing. It's to make sure that healthcare providers are able to communicate effectively with any patient they see, regardless of their race, ethnicity, culture, and class. Myself, as a practicing internist, as I become aware of different issues and different challenges that we face as a healthcare system and that I may face as a healthcare provider, just that awareness alone shapes in me a set of understandings of how I might improve the care that I provide. I think very similarly, this efforts in cultural competence aim to increase the awareness of how these social and cultural factors impact health outcomes and what healthcare providers could do in the clinical encounter to better communicate and to provide high quality care to patients. I think given that set of definitions for what cultural competence is targeted, I think it's a very important intervention as we look forward to the future.
I want to read a quote to you and get you to comment on it. One of your colleagues in Boston, Arnold Epstein, the chairman of the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Harvard School of Public Health, says that there's no single pressure point where we can say, bam, we've made this problem go away. Given that, how optimistic are you that this effort will be able to make a dent in the problems of healthcare disparities?
Sure, I respect Dr. Epstein, and he and I have had the chance to work together many times, and I do agree. I don't think that there is any one pressure point. I don't think that that's any different from any of the variety of other challenges we face in the healthcare system. If we look at the emergence of the issue of medical errors and patient safety, similarly, there's a whole set of initiatives that we need to be engaged in. And so for disparities, I'd say the same. There is no one pressure point. But I'm very hopeful in that over the last few years, this issue has gained greater attention. There's more key healthcare stakeholders out there and end users saying, what can we do? And I think that's the void and that's the need that the Disparity Solutions Center really hopes to fill. And clearly, this isn't a problem that will be solved in 1 or 2 years. But I think we're on the right road towards making significant progress.
Dr. Betancourt, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Joseph Betancourt is director of the new Disparities Solutions Center at Massachusetts General Hospital here in Boston. He spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes. And this note on a health story we've been following, there may be some relief in sight from the deadly heat wave that has hit most of the country. The blistering heat has caused numerous deaths this summer. In the Phoenix area alone, 24 people, most of them homeless, have died. Police there have been handing out water and checking to make sure air conditioners are working. Temperatures peaked around 115 degrees in Phoenix and have now returned to about 100 degrees, which is normal there for this time of year. Meantime, forecasters say a cold front is now making its way from the Midwest to the east, which could bring temperatures back to normal on the East Coast. where thousands of summer campers have been sweltering. Still to come, stories from the edge of sleepaway camp. You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. And we heard from many of you after Frank Stacio's interview with T.J. Walker, a PR specialist who commented on how the White House was handling the Karl Rove affair. Paul Whiting, who listens on Yellowstone Public Radio in Billings, Montana, wrote, "I could not believe I was hearing public radio devote airtime to how to help White House spokesperson Scott McClellan better deal with reporters. This administration is already expert at spin. They don't need coaching from so-called PR experts. Why not devote more time toward getting at the truth of this matter instead of examining ways to avoid telling the truth?" Eve Edelstein Williams of Barrington, New Hampshire, agreed. "Listening to the show today with my sons, I thought how helpful it was to your listeners to hear your guest vicariously instruct the president's press secretary on how to be more facile in his lies of omission. Walker's suggestions as to how to more blatantly dodge direct questions from the press were eerie." While Michael Ellis of Springfield, Pennsylvania writes, "Why didn't Frank ask T.J. Walker about the ethics of a spokesman lying to reporters? It seems to me that McClellan has lied or has been lied to, and if he had any honor, he would resign." Well, we also spoke to Joe Klein of Time magazine after it was revealed that Karl Rove was the first one to tell Time reporter Matthew Cooper that former Ambassador Joseph Wilson's wife worked for what Rove called the agency, and that Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame, was the one responsible for sending him to Africa. That prompted this email from Carolyn Rapson of Haverhill, Massachusetts. "I couldn't believe it when you said that the public is not focused on the Karl Rove, Valerie Plame, etc. story. Everyone I know is hanging eagerly on every word spoken and written about this situation. It's about time that Rove's vindictive behavior toward any patriot who dares to speak the truth to this administration is revealed and examined in loud detail by all news media. Rove's antics make Nixon's old dirty tricks master Joseph Segretti look like a benevolent clown." Well, Ned Hanauer wrote in reaction to an interview with Juliet Kayyem of the John F. Kennedy School of Government, who spoke of a concept some are calling torture light, the idea being batted about by terrorism experts of accepting some harsh treatment of detainees in the war on terror in exchange for complete transparency from the White House on the treatment of all prisoners. Ned writes, "Torture, light or heavy, is illegal under the Geneva Convention and the UN Convention on Torture, both of which have been signed by the U.S. Torture is also illegal under the 1996 U.S. War Crimes Act. There is no so-called middle ground. We either violate international law and act inhumanely, or we abide by law. When law professors try to square the circle, no wonder the U.S. is now held in such low esteem throughout the world." Well, also recently, I was taken to task on the use of the word TAC, T-A-C-K. Listener KB writes, "Last Friday, I noticed Robin Young said, 'Britain takes that tact,' T-A-C-T, when she meant taking that tack, T-A-C-K. She said it twice, I think, so I noticed it. We all make our share of mistakes. I just thought she might appreciate the tip." Well, KB, I do. So thank you for tactfully telling me I goofed. I should have used T-A-C-K, which means a course of action meant to minimize opposition to a goal, as opposed to tact, T-A-C-T, which means speaking without offending. Well, finally, after our talk with Jose Maso about Dominican superstar Juan Luis Guerra, we received these kudos from Errol Wright of Boston. He writes, "Buena música, pero hace mucho tiempo que estaba de moda," or "good music, but it's been a long time since it's been popular." Nevertheless, he writes, "it's good that you're giving it airtime to a wider audience." As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Muchas gracias. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
Sembrar un alto cedro de trigo y maple. bajo la colina de arroz trameado y continúa el arado con tu querer. Oh, 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 oh. Ojalá el otoño en vez de hojas secas vista mi cosecha y pipí sale. Sembra una llanura de batata y fresas. Ojalá que llueva café.
Now, and when I say summer camp, what comes to mind? For me, Girl Scout Camp Edie and wonderful memories of friendships and building campfires. But wait, when I think a little more, there was that time they almost killed us when they made us row our canoes all the way across Long Island's Great South Bay for 2 weeks of beach camping, our noses lathered with Vaseline, which back then was thought to prevent sunburn, which it doesn't. Author Margaret Atwood has a darker story. It's a tale of an elderly woman shadowed for life by an incident at sleepaway camp. Did her best friend jump off the cliff on that canoe trip, or did she slip? And author David Sedaris, now openly gay but back then scared and confused, tells of the terror he felt when anticipating several weeks away with rowdy boys.
Were it an all-girls camp, I would have been able to work up some enthusiasm. Had they sent me alone to pry leeches off the backs of bloodthirsty pygmies, I might have gone bravely. But spending a month in a dormitory full of boys, that was asking too much. I had tried to put it out of my mind, but faced with their boisterous presence, I found myself growing progressively more hysterical. My nervous tics shifted into their highest gear, and a small crowd gathered to watch what they believed to be an exotic folk dance.
Summer camp memories from David Sedaris and other authors are now collected in Sleepaway, Writings on Summer Camp. It's edited by Eric Simonoff, and he joins us on the line from Carnegie Hall Studios in New York. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, I so enjoyed this book, but it wasn't at all what I expected. I thought there's going to be recipes for s'mores and discussions of snipe hunts that people have been on, the elusive snipe. But this is a very edgy read.
Well, we thought about trying to include a diagram of a lanyard, but we couldn't find one that was suitable. We tried to make the book as eclectic as we possibly could, not just in voices heard from, but also an even mix of people who love summer camp and people who hated summer camp.
Well, we should say Dan Zanes, for instance, is in the former category. He writes about the joy of music.
Yeah, Dan is an amazing musician. Of course, he was the lead singer of the Del Fuegos and is now one of the most popular children's performers or family performers in the country. And he's a neighbor of mine, and it's like having Mick Jagger in the neighborhood if you've got a five-year-old boy,
right.
As I do. And I remember Dan mentioning how important communal singing was at summer camp and his formation as a musician, so I asked him to contribute that essay.
Right. He contributes songs such as Strike the Bell, Aft on the Poop Deck and Walking All About, There's the Second Mate, So Steady and So Stout, and on.
And then again, he also includes Friend of the Devil, the great Grateful Dead song.
That's right. What are some of the genres, if you will, about sleepaway camp that emerged as authors submitted their work?
Well, one, of course, is nostalgia. That is, people who had formative and transformative experiences at sleepaway camp and reflected back upon those experiences as adults, usually wistfully. There's a long essay by Diana Trilling from the New Yorker magazine about her experience at Camp Lenore in the 1920s. Mm. She found herself in a completely like-minded community, that it was a very artistic, very intellectual surrounding. There was a tremendous feeling of camaraderie.
Mm. So there can be a feeling of belonging, but also camp can, you know, synthesize the cruelest things about young people, and or as David Sedaris says, it's just sort of like junior high. He writes, camp lasted a month, during which time I never once had a bowel movement.
I think only David Sedaris could get away with that. It's the piece is called I Like Guys, and much of it is about a young David's attempt to distance himself as much as possible from the other obviously gay kid in the bunk.
It's just an anxiety-inducing experience. But I can remember friends that I went to camp with. I mean, I loved camp. And I can remember friends who just cried the entire time. There was something profoundly dismal about it for them.
Well, there is a streak of sadism that runs through some of the stories, which is unavoidable. Many friends who heard I was putting the collection together buttonholed me to tell me about particularly awful stories of their summer camp experiences. I think it's best summed up in a story by Steve Reinhardt called Order of the Arrow, where he talks about the sort of quintessential sadistic weirdo kid, Heitman, who in the opening lines of the story puts ticks on Porter the fat kid's eyelashes. It doesn't get much worse than, I think, ticks on your eyelashes.
Yeah. It's also a place where you either find out who you're going to be or who you're not going to be. Lev Grossman writes about creative camps, one called Green Meadow, a music camp. He gets the Best Waiter Award, which to him is the message that he's not going to be a professional cellist.
Yes, as Lev says, he goes into the camp very pumped up on the possibility of a career as a professional classical musician, and he says what he learned is what he wasn't, which was a genius. Mm-hmm. And it's a poignant but often funny essay about the rigors of music camp.
Mm-hmm. Sexuality. We mentioned David Sedaris's escapades at camp, but sexuality plays just such a huge part. What is it about camp, co-ed camp, we should point out, and sexuality?
Well, I'm trying to figure that out myself. As I say in the introduction to Sleepaway, my wife doesn't refer to the camp that I went to by any other name other than Jewish sex camp, because there's so many stories that came out of that experience that I guess have that bent.
I have to say, parents are listening to this, Eric, and
yeah,
as they're packing bags.
They might never send their child to camp after reading Sleepaway. I think a lot of it has to do with the elimination of restraints. Parents aren't around. And I think that between the heat and the swimming pools and the bathing suits and the crickets
and the dark and the flashlights.
And the dark, right. Mm-hmm. And the communal sleeping arrangements with the boys' camp and the girls' camp and all of that. And in my own camp, we had ice cream socials every Saturday, and it was a very big deal who you took to the social. There was a regimented kissing goodnight time when the boys would walk the girls to girls' camp. I mean, these were all sort of institutionalized parts of the camping experience. So it's not by accident, I don't think. These stories weren't commissioned this way. They just sort of came out that way. Many of the stories that we saw did have this, for lack of a better word, sexy component to it. Mm.
Well, you yourself attended the Joseph and Betty Harlem camp in Pennsylvania?
That's right, in the Poconos.
What were your memories of summer camp?
Well, I obviously loved camp. I went for 10 summers. One thing that I remember more than anything else is the coolness of the air in the morning and the smell of the woods and the grass walking from the bunk to the mess hall. For some reason, there are certain mornings in Pennsylvania still, if I'm there early enough in the morning, where I'll walk outside and smell those pine trees, and it'll just take me right back to the camp experience. Mm-hmm. And another less happy experience is mandatory instructional swim at 8 o'clock in the morning in a freezing cold pool. Mm-hmm. Like it or not, that's an essential part of the camp experience. Almost everybody with whom I spoke about summer camp experience mentions color war. Color war for us was basically what we all thought and prayed and focused on and wished for the other 3 weeks of the four-week summer camp session.
By the way, for those who haven't been to camp, or I went to Girl Scout camp and we didn't have it. What is the color war again?
Color war is when the camp is divided up into usually four teams. Our camp divided everyone up into four teams, red, green, blue, and gold. And over the course of a number of days, we competed like maniacs at various athletic and artistic competitions, culminating in a big sing where we had to write an original camp fight song and an original camp alma mater. Usually we just cribbed whatever the pop tune of the summer was and wrote new lyrics for it. And we just cheered and screamed with color war team spirit, and then it was announced who was in fourth place, third place, second place, and first place. And if we won, we all wept and jumped around like crazy. And to this day, I can't quite remember why.
You write also that camp was the place where you wouldn't be that weird bookish kid who always had his hand up in class. Instead, you'd be the popular kid, the lifelong camper who knew all the counselors, all the camp songs, all the camp lore. I loved camp. Camp loved me.
And, of course, it turns out that I have grown up to become the weird bookish kid, so I don't know what that says.
And it's okay. Well, Eric, it's a terrific read, although, as we said, some stories may make parents, you know, think twice about the care packages they're sending out. Eric Simonoff, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Eric Simonoff's new compilation is called Sleepaway, Writings on Summer Camp. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us.